The Worm Ouroboros by E.R. Edison. Chapter 31, Part 2. That night the king walked late in his chamber in the Iron Tower, alone. These 3 years past he had seldom resorted thither, and then, commonly, but to bear away some or other of his books to study in his own lodging. His jars and flasks and bottles of blue and green and purple glass, wherein he kept his cursed drugs and electuaries of secret composition, his athals and athanors, his crucibles, his horse-bellied retorts and alembics and bain-maries, stood a row on shelves coated with dust and hung about with the dull spider's weavings. The furnace was cold. The glass of the windows was clouded with dirt. The walls were mildewed, the air of the chamber fusty and stagnant. The king was deep in his contemplation, with a big black book open before him on the six-sided reading-stand. The damnablest of all his books, the same which had taught him aforetime what he must do when by the wicked power of enchantment he had wanted but a little to have confounded Demonland and all the lords thereof, in death and ruin. The open page under his hand was of parchment discolored with age, and the writing on the page was in characters of ancient, out-of-fashion crabbedness, heavy and black, and the great initial letters and the illuminated borders were painted and gilded in dark and fiery hues, with representations of dreadful faces and forms of serpents and toad-faced men and apes and manticores and succubi and incubi and obscene representations and figures of unlawful meaning. These were the words of the writing on the page which the king conned over and over, falling again into a deep study between whiles. And then, conning these words again of the age-old prophetic writing, touching the preordinate destinies of the royal house of Gorais in Carsey. So shall your house stand unbe unto eternity, yet walk warily, witting full certainly, that if impiously, the second time in the body, practicing grammary, one of ye catched shall be, by the feignedest subtlety, and his life losset be, brokest then this seary, dampened are you then eternally. Yearth should stow then nevermore see. Scarcely the goddess mut rescue thee, out of the hell where you will lee, unto eternity, the stairs telled hit me. Gorais the king stood up, and went to the south window. The casement bolts were rusted. He forced them, and they flew back with a shriek and a clatter and a thin shower of dust and grit. He opened the window and looked out. The heavy night grew to her depth of quiet. There were lights far out in the marshes, the lights of Lord Jus's campfires, of his armies gathered against Carsey. Scarcely without a chill might a man have looked upon that king standing by the window, for there was in the tall, lean frame of him an iron aspect, as of no natural flesh and blood, but some harder, colder element. And his countenance, like the picture of some dark divinity graven ages ago by men long dead, bore the imprint of those old qualities of unrelenting power, scorn, violence, and oppression. Ancient as night herself, yet untouched by age, young as each night when it shuts down, and old and elemental as the primeval dark. A long while he stood there, then came again to his book. Gorais the Seventh, he said in himself, that was once in the body, and I have done better than that, but not yet well enough. 'Tis too hazardous the second time alone. Corund is a man undaunted in war, but the man is too superstitious, and quaketh at that which hath not flesh and blood. apparitions and urchin shows can quite unman him. There's Corineus, careth not for god or man a point. But he is too rash and unadvised. I were mad to trust him in it. Were the goblin here, it might have carried. Damnable both sides villain, he's cast off from me. He scanned the page as if his piercing eyes would thrust beyond the barriers of time and death and discover some new meaning in the words which should agree better with the thing his mind desired while his judgment forbade it. He says, damned eternally. He says, that breaketh the series. And earth shouldst thou then never more see. Put him by. And the king slowly shut up his book and locked it with three padlocks and put back the key in his bosom. The need is not yet, he said. The sword shall have his day, and Corund. But if that fail me, then even this shall not turn me back. But I will do that I will do. In the same hour, when the king was but now entered again into his own lodgings, came through a runner of Hemmings to let them know that he, 1,500 strong, marched down the Way of Kings from Pixieland. Moreover, they were advertised that the demon fleet lay in the river that night, and it was not unlike the attack should be in the morning, by land and water. All night the king sat in his chamber, holding counsel with his generals, and ordering all things for the morrow. All night long he closed not his eyes an instant, but the others he made sleep by turns, because they should be brisk and ready for the battle. For this was their counsel, to draw out their whole army on the left bank before the bridge gate, and there offer battle to the demons at point of day. For if they should abide within doors, and suffer the demons to cut young Hemming off from the bridge-gate, then were he lost. And if the bridge-house should fall and the bridge, then might the demons lightly ship what force they pleased to the right bank, and so closely invest them in Carcy. Of an attack on the right bank they had no fear, well knowing themselves able to sit within doors and laugh at them, since the walls were there inexpugnable. But if a battle were now brought about before the bridge-gate as they were minded, and Hemming should join in the fight from the eastward, there was good hope that they should be able to crumple up the battle of the demons, driving them in upon their centre from the west, whilst Hemming smote them on the other part, whereby these should be cast into a great rout and confusion, and not be able to escape away to their ships, but there in the fenlands before Carcy should be made a prey unto the witches. When it was the cold last hour before the dawn, the generals took from their king their latest commands, ere they drew forth their armies. Corineus came forth first from the king's chamber, a little while before the rest. In the draughty corridor the lamps swung and smoked, making an uncertain windy light. Corineus espied by the stairhead the Lady Sreva standing, whether watching to bid her father adieu, or but following idle curiosity. Whichever it were, not a fico gave he for that, but, coming swiftly upon her, whisked her aside into an alcove, where the light was barely enough to let him see the pale shimmer of her silken gown, dark hair pinned loosely up in deep, snaky coils, and dark eyes shining. "My witty false one, have I caught thee? Nay, fight not. Thy breath smells like cinnamon. Kiss me, Sreva."
"I'll not," said she, striving to escape. "Naughty man, am I used thus?"
But finding she got naught by struggling, she said in a low voice,
"Well, if thou bring back Demonland tonight, then, let's hold more chat."
"Hearken to the naughty traitress," said he, "that but last night didst do me some uncivil discourtesies, and now speak of me fair. And what a devil for?
if not 'cause her seemeth, I'll likely not come back after this day's fight. But I'll come back, Mistress Kiss and Begone. Eh, by the gods, and I'll have my payment, too." His lips fed deep on her lips. His strong and greedy hands softly mastered her against her will, till with a little smothered cry she embraced him, bruising her tender body against the armor he was girt withal. Between the kisses she whispered, "Yes, yes, tonight." Surely he damned spiteful fortune that sent him not this encounter by a half hour sooner. When he was departed, Sreba remained in the shadow of the alcove to set in order her hair and apparel, not a little disarrayed in that hot wooing. Out of which darkness she had convenience to observe the leave-taking of Presmyra and her lord as they came down that windy corridor and paused at the head of the stairs. Presmyra had her arm in his.
"I know where the devil keepeth his tail, madam," said Corinth, "and I know a very traitor when I see him."
"When didst thou ever yet fare ill by following of my counsel, my lord?" said Presmyra. "Or did I refuse thee ever anything thou didst require me of? These 7 years since I put off my maiden's own for thee, and 20 kings sought me in sweet marriage, but thee I preferred before them all, seeing the falcon shall not mate with popinjays, nor the she-eagle with swans and bustards. And will you say nay to me in this?" She stood round to face him. The pupils of her great eyes were large in the doubtful lamplight, swallowing their green fires in deep pools of mystery and darkness. The rich and gorgeous ornaments of her crown and girdle seemed but a poor casket for that matchless beauty which was hers. Her face, where every noble and sweet quality and everything desirable of earth or heaven had framed each feature to itself. The glory of her hair like the red sun's glory, her whole body's poise and posture like a stately bird's new-lighted after flight.
"Though it be very rhubarb to me," said Corhan, "shall I say nay to thee this tide?" "Not this tide, my queen."
"Thanks, dear my lord. Disarm him, and bring him in, if you may. The king shall not refuse us this, to pardon his folly, when thou shalt have obtained this victory for him upon our enemies."
The lady Sreba might hear no more, hearkened she never so curiously. But when they were now come to the stair-foot, Corund paused a minute to try the buckles of his harness. His brow was clouded.
"This shall be a battle mortal fierce and doubtless for both parties. Against such mighty opposites as here we have, 'tis possible. No more, but kiss me, dear lass, and if— Tush, 'twill not be, and yet I'd not leave it unsaid. If ill tide ill, I'd not have thee waste all thy days a-grieving. Thou knowest I am not one of your sour, envious jacks, bear so poor conceit of themselves, they begrudge their wives should wed again, lest the next husband should prove the better man."
But Presmyra came near to him with good and merry countenance.
"Let me stop thy mouth, my lord. These be foolish thoughts for a great king going into battle. Come back in triumph, and in the mean season, think on me that wait on thee, as a star waits, dear my lord, and never doubt the issue."
"The issue," answered he, "I'll tell thee when 'tis done. I'm no astronomer. I'll hew with my sword, love, spoil some of their guesses if I may."
"Good fortune and my love go with thee," she said. Sreva, coming forth from her hiding, hastened to her mother's lodging, and there found her that had just bid adieu to her two sons, her face all blubbered with tears.
In the same instant came the duke her husband to change his sword, and the lady Zenambria caught him about the neck and would have kissed him. But he shook her off, crying that he was weary of her and her slobbering mouth, menacing her besides with filthy imprecations, that he would drag her with him and cast her to the demons, who, since they had a strong loathing for such ugly tits and stale old trots, would no doubt hang her up or disembowel her, and so rid him of his lasting consumption. Therewith he went forth hastily. But his wife and daughter, either weeping upon other, came down into the court, meaning to go up to the tower above the water gate to see the army marshaled beyond the river. And on the way, Sreeva related all she had heard said betwixt Corund and Presmyra. In the court they met with Presmyra's self, and she, going with blithe countenance and light tread and humming a merry tune, bade them good morrow.
"You can bear these things more bravelier than we, madam," said to Zenambria. "We be too gentle-hearted, methinks, and pitiful."
Presmyra replied upon her, "'Tis true, madam, I have not the weak sense of some of you soft-eyed whimpering ladies. And by your leave I'll keep my tears, which be great spoilers of the cheeks beside, until I need 'em." When they were passed by,
"Is it not a stony-livered and a shameless hupsy, O my mother?" said Sreeva. "And is it not scandalous, her laughing and jesting, as I have told it thee, when she did bid him adieu, devising only how best she might coax him to save the life of yonder chambering traitorous hound?"
"With whom," said Zenambria, "she want to do the thing I'd think shame to speak on. Truly this foreign madam, with his loose and wanton ways, doth scandal the whole land for us."
But Presmyra went her way, glad that she had not, by an eyelid's flicker, let her lord guess what a dread possessed her mind, who had in all the bitter night seen strange and cruel visions, portending loss and ruin of all she held dear. Now when dawn appeared, was the king's whole army drawn out in battle array before the bridge house. Corineus held command on the left. There followed him 1,500 chosen troops of Witchland, with the dukes of Trace and Estraganzia, besides these kings and princes with their outlandish levies: the king of Minia, Count Escobrine of Seusha, and the Red Foliot. Corsus led the center, and with him went King Erp of Elien and his green-coated slingcasters, the king of Nevria, Axticus, lord of Permio, the king of Gilta, Olus of Tecapon, and other captains. 1,700 men in all. The right the Lord Corund had chosen for himself. 2,000 Witchland troops, the likeliest and best, hardened to war in Impland and Demonland and the southeastern borders, followed his standard, beside the heavy spearmen of Baltari and swordsmen of Butani and Ar. Viglus his son was there, and the Count of Thromne, Cadarus, Diderus of Largos, and the Lord of Estramarine. But when the demons were ware of that great army standing before the bridge-gate, they put themselves in array for battle, and their ships made ready to move up the river under Carcy, if by any means they might attack the bridge by water, and so cut off for the witches their way of retreat. It was bright low sunshine, and the splendor of the jeweled armor of the demons, and their many-colored kirtles, and the plumes that were in their helms, was a wonder to behold. This was the order of their battle. On their left, nearest the river, was a great company of horse, and the Lord Brandok Daha to lead them, on a great golden dun with fiery eyes. His island men, Melkar and Tharmrod, with Camarar of Strapardon, and Styrkmir and Stipmar, were the chief captains that rode with him to that battle. Next to these came the heavy troops from the east, and the Lord Jus himself their leader, on a tall, fierce, big-boned chestnut. About him was his picked bodyguard of horse, with Brummery of Shaws their captain. And in his battle were these chiefs besides: Astar of Rettray, and Gismore Gleam of Justdale, and Peridor of Sewell. Lord Spitfire led the centre, and with him Fendar of Shalgrath, and Emeron, and the men of Dalny, great spearmen. Also the Duke of Azumel, sometime allied with Witchland. There went also with him the Lord Grow, that scanned still those ancient walls with a heavy heart, thinking on the great king within, and with what mastery of intellect and will he ruled those dark, turbulent, and bloody men who bear sway under him, thinking on Queen Presmyra. To his sick imagining, the blackness of Carcy, which no bright morning light might lighten, seemed not, as of old, the image and emblem of the royal house of Witchland and their high magnificency and power on earth, but rather the shadow thrown before of destiny and death ready to put down that power forever. Which, whether it should so befall or no, he did not greatly care, being aweary of life and life's fevers, wild longings and exorbitant affects, whereof he thought he had now learned much. That to him, who, as it seemed, must still adhere to his own foes, abandoning the other's service, fortune, through whatever chop, could bring no peace at last. On the demon right, the Lord Goldry Blushko streamed his standard, leading to battle the South Firthers and the heavy spearmen of Mardardale and Throwater. With him was King Gaslark and his army of Goblinland, and levies from Ocheria and Eustlan, lately revolted from their allegiance to King Gorice. The Lord Zig, with his light horse of Ramaric and Kelialand and the Northern Dales, covered their flank to the eastward. Gorice the king beheld these dispositions from his tower above the water gate. He beheld, besides, a thing the demons might not see from below, for a little swelling of the ground that cut off their view. The marching of men far away along the way of kings from the eastward. Young Hemming with the vassalry of Pixieland and Maltraeni. He sent a trusty man to apprise Corund of it. Now, Lord, just let blow up the battle call, and with the loud braying of the trumpets, the hosts of the demons swung forth to battle. And the clash of those armies when they met before Carcy was like the bursting of a thundercloud. But like a great sea cliff, patient for ages under the storm wind's furies, that not one night's loud wind and charging breakers can wear away, nor yet a thousand thousand nights, the embattled strength of Witchland met their onset, mixed with them, flung them back, and stood unremoved. Corrin's iron battalions bear in this first brunt the heaviest load, and bear it through. For the ships, with young Hesper Golthring in command, most fiercely urging them, ran up the river to force the bridge, and Corund, whiles he met on his front the onset of the Flower of Demonland, must still be shot at by these behind. Hakmon and Viglus, those young princes his sons, were charged with the warding of the bridge and walls to burn and break up their ships, and they, of all hands bestirring them twice and thrice, threw back the demons when they had gotten a footing on the bridge. Until, in fine, both sides for a long space fighting very cruelly, it fell out very fatally against Hesper and his power. His ships all lighted in a low, and the more part of his folk burned, or drowned, or slain with the sword. And himself, after many and grievous wounds in his last attempt, left alone on the bridge, and crawling to have got away, was stabbed in with a dagger and died. After this the ships fell back down the river, so many as might avail thereto, and those sons of Corund, their task manfully fulfilled, came forth with their folk to join in the main battle. and the smoke of the burning ships was like incense in the nostrils of the king, watching these things from his tower above the water gate. Little pause was there betwixt this first brunt and the next, for Hemming now bare down from the east, drave in Zig's horsemen that were hampered in the heavy ground, and pressed his onset home on the demon right. Along the whole line from Coran's post beside the river to the eastern flank where Hemming joined Corineus, the witches now set on most fiercely, and now were the odds of numbers which were at first against them swung mightily in their favor. And under this great side-blow on his flank, not all the Lord Goldry Blushko's soldiership, nor all the terror of his might in arms, could uphold the demon's battle line. Yard by yard they fell back before the witches, most gloriously maintaining their array unbroken, though the outland allies broke and fled. Meantime, on the demon left, Jus and Brandok Daha most stubbornly withstood that onslaught, albeit they had to do with the first and chosen troops of Witchland, in which struggle befell the most bloody fighting that was yet seen that day, and the stour of battle so aspare and so mortal that it was hard to see how any man should come out from it with life, since not a man of either side would budge an inch, but die there in their steps, if he might not rather slay the foe before him. So the armies swayed for an hour, like wrestlers locked. But in the end, the Lord Corund had his way, and held his ground before the bridge-gate. Romanard of Dalny, galloping to Lord Jus, where he paused a while, panting, from violence of the battle, brought him by Spitfire's command tidings from the right, telling him Goldry's self could hold no longer against such odds, that the centre yet held, but at the next onset was like to break, or the right wing else be driven in upon their rear, and all overwhelmed. If your highness cannot throw back Corund, all is lost. In these short minutes lull, if lull it were, when all the time the battle, like a sounding sea, rolled on with a ceaseless noise of riding and slaying and the clang of arms, just chose. Demonland and the whole world's destinies hung on his choice. He had no counselor. He had no time for slow deliberation. In such a moment, imagination, resolution, swift decision, all high gifts of nature, are not. Swift horses gulfed and lost in the pit which fate the enemy digged in the way before them. Except painful knowledge, stored up patiently through years of practice, shall have prepared a road sure and clean for their flying hoofs to bear them in the great hour of destiny. So it was from the beginning with all great captains. So with the Lord Jus in that hour when ruin swooped upon his armies. For 2 minutes' space he stood silent, then sent Brimery of Shaws galloping westward like one minded to break his neck with his orders to Lord Brandok Daha, and Romanard eastward again to Spitfire. And Jus himself, riding forward among his soldiers, shouted among them in a voice that was like a trumpet thundering, that they should now make ready for the fiercest trial of all. "Is my cousin mad?" said Lord Brandok Daha, when he saw and understood the whole substance and matter of it. "Or hath he found Corund so tame to deal with, he can make shift without me, and well nigh half his strength, and yet withstand him?" "He looseth this hold," answered Brimery, "to snatch at safety. 'Tis desperate, but all other ways we but wait on destruction. Our right is clean driven in, the left holdeth but hardly. He chargeth your highness break their centre if you may. They have somewhat dangerously advanced their left, and therein is their momentary peril, if we be swift enough. But remember that here of this side is their greatest power before us, and if we be whelmed ere you can compass it—" "No more but yes," said Lord Brandok Daha. "Time gallopeth, so must we." Even so, in that hour when Goldry and Zig, giving way step by step before superior odds, were bent back well nigh with their backs to the river, and Corund, on the demon's left, had, after a bitter battle, checked and held them, and threatened now to complete in one more great blow the ruin of them all. Jus, choosing a desperate expedient to meet a danger that else must destroy him, weakened his hard-pressed left to throw Brandok the Ha and well-nigh 800 horse into Spitfire's battle to drive a wedge betwixt Corsus and Corineus. It was now long past noon. The tempest of battle that had quietened a while for utter weariness roared forth anew from wing to wing as Brandok the Ha hurled his horsemen upon Corsus and the subject allies, while all along the battle line the demons rallied to fling back the enemy. For a breathless while the issue hung in suspense. Then the men of Gilta and Nevria broke and fled. Brandok the Ha and his cavalry swept through the gap, wheeled right and left, and took Corsus and Corineus in flank and rear. There fell in this onset Axtacus, lord of Permio, the kings of Elien and Gilta, Gorius, the son of Corsus, the count of Seusha, and many other noblemen and men of mark. Of the demons, many were hurt and many slain, but none of great note save Camerar of Strapardon, whose head Corineus swapped off clean with a blow of his battle-axe, and Trentmar, whom Corsus smote full in the stomach with a javelin, so that he fell down from his horse and was dead at once. Now was all the left and center of the witches' battle thrown into great confusion, and the allies most of all fallen into disorder, and fain to yield themselves and pray for mercy. The king, seeing the extent of this disaster, sent a galloper to Corund, who straightway sent to Corsus and Corineus, commanding them get them at their speediest with all their folk back into Carcy, while time yet served. Himself, in the meantime, showing now like the sun his greatest countenance in his lowest estate, set on with his weary army to stem the advance of Jus, who now momently gathered fresh force against him, and to keep open for the rest of the king's forces their way by the bridge-gate into Carcy. Corineus, when he understood it, galloped thither with a band of men to aid Corund, and this did likewise Hemming and Decologus and other captains of the witches. But Corsus himself, counting the day lost, and considering that he was an old man and had fought now long enough, gat him privily back into Carcy as quickly as he was able. And truly he was bleeding from many wounds. By this great stand of Corund and his men was time won for a great part of the residue of the army to escape into Carcy. And ever the witches were put aback and lost much ground, yet ever the Lord Corund, by his great valiance and noble heart, re-comforted the folk, so that they gave back very slowly, most bloodily disputing the ground foot by foot to the bridge-gate, that they also might win in again, so many as might. Jus said, "This is the greatest deed of arms that ever I in the days of my life did see. And I have so great an admiration and wonder in my heart for Corund that almost I would give him peace. But I have sworn now to have no peace with Witchland." Lord Grow was in that battle with the demons. He ran Diderus through the neck with his sword, so that he fell down and was dead. Corund, when he saw it, heaved up his axe, but changed his intention in the manage, saying, "O landskip of iniquity, shalt thou kill beside me the men of mine household? But my friendship sitteth not upon a weather vane. Live, and be a traitor." But Grow, being mightily moved with these words, and staring at great Corund, wide-eyed, like a man roused from a dream, answered, "Have I done amiss? 'Tis easy remedied." Therewith he turned about and slew a man of demon-land. Which Spitfire seeing, he cried out upon Grow in a great rage for a most filthy traitor, and bloodily rushing in, thrust him through the buckler into the brain. In such wise, and by such a sudden vengeance, did the Lord grow most miserably end his life days. Who, being a philosopher and a man of peace, careless of particular things of earth, had followed and observed all his days steadfastly one heavenly star. Yet now, in the bloody battle before Carcy, died in the common opinion of men, a manifold perjured traitor, that had at length gotten the guerdon of his guile. Now came the Lord Jus with a great rout of men, armed on his great horse, with his sword dripping with blood, and the battle sprang up into yet more noise and fury, and great manslaying befell, and many able men of Witchland fell in that stour, and the demons had almost put them from the bridge-gate. But the Lord Corund, rallying his folk, swung back yet again the battle-tide, albeit he was by a great odds outnumbered. And he sought none but Jus himself in that deadly melee, who, when he saw him coming, he refused him not, but made against him most fiercely, and with great clanging blows they swapped together a while, until Corund hewed Jus's shield asunder and struck him from his horse. Jus, leaping up again, thrust up at Corund with his sword, and with the violence of the blow brake through the rings of his byrnie about his middle, and drave the sword into his breast. And Corund felled him to earth with a great downstroke on the helm, so that he lay senseless. Still the battle raged before the bridge-gate, and great wounds were given and taken of either side. But now the sons of Corund saw that their father had lost much of his blood and waxed feeble. And the residue of his folk seeing it too, and seeing themselves so few against so many, began to be abashed. So those sons of Corund, riding up to him on either side with a band of men, made him turn back with them and go with them in by the gate to Carcy, the which he did like a man amazed, and knowing not what he doeth. And indeed it was a great marvel how so great a lord, wounded to the death, might sit on horseback. In the great court he was gotten down from his horse. The Lady Presmyra, when she perceived that his harness was all red with blood, and saw his wound, fell not down in a swoon, as another might, but took his arm about her shoulder, and so supported, with her stepsons to help her, that great frame which could no more support itself, yet had till that hour borne up against the whole world's strength in arms. Leeches came that she had called for, and a litter, and they brought him to the banquet hall. But after no long while, those learned men confessed his hurt was deadly, and all their cunning naught. Whereupon, much disdaining to die in bed, not in the field fighting with his enemies, the Lord Corund caused himself, completely armed and weaponed, with the stains and dust of the battle yet upon him, to be set in his chair, there to await death. Hemming, when this was done, came to tell it to the king, where from the tower above the water-gate he beheld the end of this battle. The demons held the bridge-house. The fight was done. The king sat in his chair looking down to the battlefield. His dark mantle was about his shoulders. He leaned forward, resting his chin in his hand. They of his bodyguard, 9 or 10, stood huddled together some yards away, as if afraid to approach him. As Hemming came near, the king turned his head slowly to look at him. The low sun, swinging blood-red over Tenemos, shone full on the king's face. And as Hemming looked in the face of the king, fear got hold upon him, so that he durst not speak a word to the king, but made obeisance and departed again, trembling like one who has seen a sight beyond the veil. End of chapter 31.